Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about buying a house today. It can be complicated, and even more so if you find problems after the sale. Our guest today is Kevin Trost. He is a partner in the Axley Law Firm, a member of the Business and Litigation Practices Groups. He primarily deals with issues involving real estate, personal injury, and financial matters. So we'll talk with him about legalities surrounding home sales and take some other legal questions as well. And just a reminder, our discussion today is intended as general information, should not be relied on or construed as legal advice. And Kevin Trost, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. It's nice to talk with you again.
You know, when it comes to finding problems after you buy a house, you certainly can talk about that on a personal level. I can as well. But tell us about your experience.
Sure. I mean, one of the reasons why I got into this area of law is because of my own personal experience in the area. Specifically, my family and I bought a house several years ago. And a couple years into buying the house, we discovered there were some perhaps undisclosed issues and problems with the house. It's kind of interesting. We were actually out of state at the time when a bad thunderstorm came through, and we were getting reports from our neighbors that a lot of basements were having water in them. And we came back, and lo and behold, so did we. And so we had called our insurer, and they sent out a remediation contractor. The remediation contractor is drying out the basement and just about done with his work. And he's starting to pull his equipment out, and he makes the remark that, you know, every time I come through your front door, it just smells a little off. Let me go get my moisture meter. And so he did. And he placed it against the walls on either side of the front door, and they were reading 70%.
No.
And that led him to conclude, there's something else going on here with this house, more so than just, you know, a flooded basement. And what that led to was the discovery that the flashing on the roof of the house was in such poor shape that is basically letting water in throughout the structure of the house wherever there was flashing. And this was a house that had a lot of flashing. You know, obviously, flashing is where the side of your roof meets the side wall of your house. And if that's leaking water into the structure of your house, especially over time, that can lead to many significant problems. That ended up
in court, I imagine.
That ended up in court. It ended up in a two-year lawsuit involving the sellers of the house that we bought the house from, our home inspector, as well as a roofer that the sellers had redo the roof about 7 years before we bought the house.
Oh, my goodness me. So I hope it turned out okay for you.
It did end up turning out okay. I mean, even though it was a protracted two-year-long ordeal, we ended up settling 1 week before trial for 95% of our claimed damages, including the attorney's fees.
Oh, man. So an expensive little proposition. You know, June in Dowsman has a question that kind of relates, I think, to what your experience in a way. It has to do, I believe, with an inspector. June, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on. I just had a quick question. I'm a realtor, and I had referred an inspector to go out and do a pre-listing inspection for me. So I told the inspector that I had used for many years that my seller had requested an inspection to be done before I listed the property. And when the inspector went out to the property, he decided he was going to solicit the seller and make him an offer on the side to purchase the property and try and cut me out of the transaction, even though I've known this inspector for probably over 16 years and given him many, many transactions, much business. So just wondering, I've kind of looked into this, and no one really, I guess, keeps track of these inspectors, make sure they do their job and they do everything legal and on the up and up. And I'm just wondering if you have any comments on that.
Hmm.
Wow.
So inspectors, it's not the question I thought you were going to ask, you, but it's an interesting one for sure. What do you think, Kevin Trost?
Yeah, it certainly is an interesting one. Not one that you typically hear with regards to a home inspector. I mean, with regards to your specific situation, it sounds like that home inspector made a mistake there or took a wrong turn, because he's probably not going to get much business from you down the road. From a legal standpoint, the thought that crosses through my head at first is, if you already have a listing agreement with the with the seller of the house, and you directed the home inspector to go take a look at the house, then you might be in a situation where, under the listing agreement, you're entitled to any commission on the sale if the home inspector goes ahead and buys the house.
So that would be one thing. Otherwise, I'm not sure what you could do except not give that person any more business.
Yeah, and mention it to on the part of the home inspector.
Yeah, not
for future business.
Well, let's talk about home inspectors a little bit. Did you use a home inspector in your situation?
Absolutely, and even though our home inspector didn't turn up a very significant flaw, for which there was evidence to be seen that would suggest there were problems with the roof. In general, it's always a good idea for a buyer of real estate to have a home inspection. Home inspectors, there's a lot of home inspectors out there, and there's a wide variety of knowledge amongst home inspectors. There's some that just go through the minimal amount of courses that they have to take in order to get licensed as a home inspector. And then there's others that have not only gone through that training, but also have many decades of experience in performing home inspections and can really give good insights. And like many industries, you'll find home inspectors that are really out there really trying to find any problems that there might be with the house. And then on the other side, you have some home inspectors that are really in it to get their few hundred bucks from each inspection, and will schedule two or three inspections a day and try and do a volume business to, make good on their business.
Mm. Yeah, I've had good home inspectors, and I've had home inspectors that I wish I hadn't gotten. And so I understand. The home that I live in now, the home inspector I had a lot of experience. I got a very detailed report at the end, and probably it may have cost me a little bit more to have this home inspector versus, say, the one I had prior home that I had. But I was much happier, and I think it turned out to be he was spot on with the things that he had to say in his inspection. So it was, are there things that a home inspector doesn't have to tell you?
There absolutely are. The Wisconsin statutes and the Wisconsin Administrative Code really set forth the items that home inspectors have to specifically comment on when they're going through the house. And they're basically the structural components, the operational components of the house. There's also specific topics that they're not obligated to talk about. One of those that frequently comes up is the presence of vermin, like rats, mice, those type of things. And so that's something that when you're buying a house, you need to pay attention to. The home inspector will go up into the attic and look around, poke around, tell you that the roof looks perfectly fine. It looks like you have a good amount of insulation up there, but they're under no legal obligation to tell you that while they were up there, they saw little calling cards of things that might be residing in the attic. So it's, in my opinion, you should always go up there and take a look for yourself as well, in addition to having the home inspector look up there.
Billy in Monona has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Billy.
Hi. That was good advice he just said about checking that out yourself, because my experiences with home inspectors is that, first of all, the realtor brings in the home inspector for you, and they don't want to blow the deal. They want to sell the house. So if that home inspector blows the deal for the realtor, they won't use them anymore. So you really have to be careful. You have to, like the gentleman said, you need to watch yourself, because they're not looking after your interest. Many times they're looking after their own interest. They want to get paid, and they don't want the realtor not to use them.
No.
And that's all I have to say.
All right. Thank you very much for calling.
If I could chime in, Larry.
Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
I completely agree with that analysis. There are a certain set of home inspectors that do wonderful marketing to realtors in order to keep their business up, to always have a lot of homes to inspect. And while the home inspector might point out a few things that might cost a few hundred or a couple thousand dollars, a lot of times it's really not in their interest to find something incredibly significant that could possibly kill the sale. They find enough to justify their existence, but that might be it.
Is there an association or a professional association of home inspectors that, I mean, would kind of help? I mean, could you look for somebody like that?
That's true. There is a Wisconsin Association of Home Inspectors. I believe there's also a national association. From what I've seen amongst home inspectors, it's always a good idea to try and check out the home inspector you're planning on using yourself. A lot of them will have a website. And if somebody's been around for, 20 or 30 years as a home inspector, you have a better chance that the person has the expertise and has the knowledge to do a good job. Also, if you're going to go with the home inspector that your realtor is suggesting to you, and a lot of times they'll suggest one or two names of possible home inspectors, you might want to take a really deep dive into looking into those people before you decide to go with them.
Hmm. Kevin Trost, our guest today, an attorney, specializes in creditors' rights, home foreclosures, the legal side of housing sales. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the legal side of housing sales with Kevin Trost today. He is an attorney with the Axley Law Firm. It's great to have him back to talk about home sales. Peggy emailed that she purchased a home from a church. They wanted to donate 60 feet of the property to an adjacent cemetery to help them sort of realign their driveway for better access. She was perfectly fine with this, as the property was a little over 2 acres. Nothing was brought up during the closing about this, and she assumed the paperwork had all been done. Several months later, she received a quit claim deed in the mail requesting she sign and return it due to the fact that she'd just gotten home from the hospital after having open heart surgery. She put it aside and never signed it and simply forgot about it. She's not received any further mail regarding this matter. Since the paperwork was never completed, who owns the 60 feet?
Well, interesting question. Well, if the the quitclaim deed was never signed off on, then, the party that originally had that part of the land continues to have that part of the land.
But okay.
I don't think there's necessarily a time limitation on, the expiration of the quitclaim deed. So if she still wanted to go ahead and sell and go through with that transaction today, I think she could get in touch with the people on the other side and go ahead and sign it.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Peggy, I hope that helps. Martha in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Martha.
Hello, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I am a realtor, and I am calling to comment on a previous caller that had just commented on home inspectors and realtors, picking them. First of all, it's realtor, not realtors. But he had made the comment that realtors pick home inspectors that will pass the inspection just so we get a paycheck. I've been selling real estate for 20 years, and it's not common practice for most of my peers, as well as myself. Our long-term goal is to have a happy client so we get repeat business. So I think that's kind of a common misconception. We actually try to do a very good job for our clients.
Martha, thank you very much for calling. Martha's a realtor. What do you have to say, Kevin?
Well, I appreciate Martha calling in and providing that perspective, because I think just like there's a lot of different home inspectors out there, there's a lot of different realtors out there as well. And as you see in many fields, there are a lot of people that are like Martha and in her position where she's really interested in representing her client and making sure her client is happy with the real estate transaction that goes through.
Yeah, for sure. Martha, thanks so much for calling. I really appreciate it. Cody in Richland Center, your turn. Hi, Cody.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I was just calling because I live in Richland County and I rent a property for the last 7 years on a month-to-month lease. And for five of the 7 years, our house has been full of moisture. We have mold, we have mice and bugs, and nothing's really getting done about it. We brought it up once. The landlord took the carpet out of half of our house and never replaced it. So we were thinking about, getting the health inspector out in 2018, but we never did because we were scared of eviction. And we just did that recently. And we had him served an abatement paper where he had to fix it. But he chose to rather sell the house, and the health and human services inspector spent over 70 days helping him sell the house rather than fix it. And so now the new owner is also trying to evict us, and we're on our third eviction now. So I just want to warn people, if you're renting, it's not a very good idea to call the health inspector. And also they say to call the building inspector for a lot of the issues, and there isn't one for Richland County.
Comment, Kevin.
Yeah. In my experience, even towns that don't have a permanent building inspector, they'll have somebody that serves as the building inspector if you call the town or the municipality and ask. And it might be some private individual that works for like an engineering company or something of that nature and is just on a contract basis serving as the building inspector. So in most cases, I would say there probably is a building inspector out there. You just need to do some calling and digging in order to find one. Also, in my experience, in this type of situation, if a tenant is legitimately raising issues and regarding pests and moisture problems in a property and the landlord isn't doing something about it, you're right, there is a rent abatement issue present. And if the landlord goes through and what looks like evicts somebody for raising those issues, there might be further legal repercussions for that landlord.
So it might be worth it for Cody to talk with an attorney?
It might be. least yeah. have his case reviewed in greater detail.
Yeah, there you go, Cody. Thank you for calling. Luke in Moose Lake, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Luke.
Hey, guys. I bought 15 acres because of, obviously, the property has a house and other outbuildings. After I bought the house, I wanted to put up another house on it, which the advertisement said that these are building lots if you subdivide them. But now I talked to the town engineer, and he says most of your property is federal wetlands, and that was never disclosed. Is there anything that, you know, can happen with that?
Yeah. What about that, Kevin Trost?
That sounds interesting. I mean, you're calling from Minnesota. I'm going to answer your question like your property that you're buying is in Wisconsin. If it's a Minnesota property, there's not much I can comment on about that because the laws in Minnesota might be slightly different. I'm not, although they might be the same, I'm not sure. But assuming it's, if I was treating it like a property that you were buying in Wisconsin, I would recommend that you consult an attorney because there are certain disclosures that go along with the purchase of a property that a seller has to make. And if the seller is advertising and holding the property out as a property that can be subdivided or is ready to be subdivided, and that is clearly not the case, and the seller makes no mention of protected federal wetlands or whatnot, there might be a situation where there was some false advertising involved in the sale of that property.
Yeah. So it would be worth it talking to an attorney on that, the details of it, Luke, from the sound of it. Yeah.
I think so. It sounds a little fishy.
Luke, thank you. Jim in Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got a similar question along those same lines. If somebody, say you bought a home and you had the home inspector do the inspection and everything, didn't find much, like you said, a few token items, but then later you discovered it's a poured concrete foundation and there's a lot of cracks, there might be some movement. Not quite sure, but say hypothetically that there was some structural deficiencies in the foundation that existed at the time of sale. What recourse is there for that? And what's the time frame? Is there a time limit on seeking recourse? Now, keep in mind, the sale's already done. You've already lived in the home. So I guess what would you do then?
Well, sure. There's a couple things you need to consider. One, in terms of legal recourse, if you're looking at going to potentially look at the seller, and whether they had a duty to disclose these kind of problems, the seller's duty only kicks in about things that they were aware about. So if you were going to bring a claim against the seller, you'd have to be able to affirmatively show that the seller knew or, you know, practically knew for all intents and purposes that there were cracks in the foundation, that there were structural problems, and didn't disclose them on the real estate condition report. With respect to the home inspector, a home inspector's that the structure of the house, the foundation, that is something that they're required to comment on. Their duties are a bit limited in that they can only comment on things that are readily accessible during the course of the inspection. So if it's a situation where, you know, for example, if you had a normal basement, but the sellers of the house, you know, have a ton of stuff sitting in their basement that's blocking the view of part of the basement wall, a home inspector might not have an obligation to be able to comment on anything that's behind the stuff. Because you have to remember, when the home inspector is coming through, the house still belongs to the seller of the house. And so a home inspector can't just willy-nilly go and move everything around and alter people's stuff that's in the house in order to conduct their inspection. They can only comment on what's reasonably visible.
I got it. Jim, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. A listener in Madison emailed to ask if condo associations are required to disclose known asbestos issues. In this case, it had to do with original flooring in kitchens that are known to contain asbestos.
Hmm. That's a good one. Asbestos is always something that comes up. It's, you know, outside of water, the presence of asbestos is one of the more common ones that people raise when they're looking into a potential legal problem with a real estate sale. What I would be looking at is whether or not the seller of the condo had knowledge of the presence of asbestos. And it might be something that the seller should know or does know because it's something that's generally known throughout the condo association.
So would there be some recourse on something like that?
Potentially, but I think the recourse would involve the seller of the condo because the condo association isn't going to be filling out a real estate condition report with the sale of the property. It's just going to be the seller.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. There you go. Thank you for that question. Linda in Appleton will give you a chance. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Mine is a follow-up asbestos question as well. I have a home that I believe was built in 1948. I've lived in it for probably over 25 years. I had a new roof put on recently. In the process, there was a downpour, and I got water damage in my attic. And I did have a home inspection before I bought the home, but when I went to have the quotes for mitigation, it was discovered I have vermiculite underneath fiberglass insulation in my attic. And I was told by my insurance company that's a pollutant. It's not covered by my insurance, the removal of it. Can't remove the wet asbestos that I have the wet insulation. And so I've been in a holding pattern because I'm having trouble getting anyone to pay for it. And I'm thinking I may need an attorney, but it wasn't disclosed in my home inspection. And now I find out it's not covered by my insurance. And I'm having the roofing company subcontracted my roof out to someone else. So I'm kind of in a mess here in a holding pattern trying to get moving forward to get my home put back together.
And it's
they can't
been,
demo the ceilings because if they demo the ceilings, the vermiculite will fall down.
Yeah.
And that has trace asbestos.
Well, Kevin Trost, what do you think about it? And this is something you've had this home for 25 years, Linda.
Yeah, right. But the problem is that I was told it's fine if you don't disturb it. But it's gotten wet, and it's got fiberglass on top of it that got wet, and that needs to be removed.
That's a tricky situation. I feel sorry for your situation, Linda. I think you're going to encounter a problem most likely because, you know, especially with respect to any home inspector or seller, simply because 25 years has passed. And it'll be very difficult to bring a claim going back 25 years after so much time has passed. With respect to your insurance company, obviously the details of your policy are going to control as to whether or not the insurance company has an obligation to do something about the vermiculite. You might want to have somebody review the terms of the policy to make sure that your insurance claims adjuster is reading the policy right. I've dealt with situations where the there's been a problem, and there's been vermiculite insulation in the attic, and it's had to be remediated and removed, and you need a specialized contractor in order to do that. Just having any old contractor remove that vermiculite could be problematic because it could lead to spreading the vermiculite throughout the rest of your house, which is something you don't want, because you do not want asbestos particles floating around in the air of your house. So as far as my recommendation, at least my thoughts based on what you said, I would have somebody take a look at your insurance policy to see if the insurance company is being up and up and accurate in their read on the policy. And then also you'd have to look into a specialized contractor who's familiar with asbestos abatement, because regardless of who's paying for it, you want it done right, because what could happen otherwise if you just have somebody off the street taking out the vermiculite is further contamination of your house.
Linda, there you go. I wish we had better news for you, but at least have somebody take a look at your policy and make sure that the company that has your policy is telling you the right information. Pat in Elm Grove, on to you now. Hi, Pat.
Yes, hi. We had a neighbor that had vermiculite in his house, in his attic, and he had it tested, and they found out it did not contain asbestos. So maybe she could have it tested, and then if it doesn't have asbestos in it, she's okay.
Yeah. It's certainly worth a try. Thanks, Pat. Appreciate it. Kevin and Toma, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. I have an easement question. We have a farm. It's been in the family for over 45 years, and we have a field road that accesses the land off a county highway. It's next to a cemetery. Well, we've decided to sell the property and did a title search, and it turns out that cemetery owns the land over which we pass on this access road that we've, you know, been using for as long as we've owned the property, and it was used by the farmer before we owned it. The cemetery was deeded to the Catholic Church. It was a Catholic church that had the cemetery in 1863, and that Catholic church burned in the mid-1870s. I don't think there's been a burial in that cemetery since then, so it's essentially been abandoned. I've been told that the township has the obligation to maintain the cemetery, such as mow it and take care of it, but I'm trying to find somebody that would potentially sign an easement on an abandoned cemetery like that. Any idea who might have the authority to do that?
Hmm. That's a good question, Kevin. Follow-up question for you. Have you and your family been maintaining that the road that you take over the cemetery's land?
Yes, we farm around it, so it gets mowed, and we use it to access it.
Okay.
So basically, it's graveled. There was in the mid-60s, there was a gravel pit on the back part of the property, and the gravel trucks used that to access this county highway off of which it comes.
Hmm. Sure.
So it's a pretty good road with a culvert and everything else.
Yeah, because I'm thinking just off the top of my head that if your family's been maintaining that road for something on the order of 20 years or so, you might have a claim of adverse possession that you've been using that road and you've been taking care of that road. And so if somebody, you know, who actually owned the cemetery and was the titled owner of the land underneath the road came by, they could see that, hey, somebody else is maintaining this road. if they have a problem with it, they should do something about it.
Yeah. And the fact that isn't there, you know, the fact that the road has been used all that time by that person, doesn't that give that person some rights to the road? I know in city situations, I think I can remember situations where somebody was using somebody else's drive or portion of their driveway for many years, and then they were able to continue to do it even after it was sold to another person who didn't want them to use it.
Yeah, that's true too. That is true.
So there you go. Yeah, there you go, Kevin. Thank you very much for calling. Good luck. Appreciate it. Brock in Madison, you have something for us. Hi, Brock.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Quick question. My daughter bought a house last summer in Madison. There was no disclosure that a gas fireplace did not work. I assume they had an inspector test it and that it did turn on. They turned it on once. It has not worked since. And it seems hard to believe that it would have suddenly stopped functioning just when they bought the house. So do you think they have an issue where they can go to the previous owner and say, look, you know, maybe you ought to fix this because it's pretty clear that it wasn't working when we bought the house?
Yeah, it sounds like they might have a basis to go back and ask that. You know, you can always make a demand, send a letter to the former owner of the house explaining the situation and see what kind of response you get. You know, one of the ways of showing, at least in court, that there was a problem that a seller of a house knew about is to show that ever since you've owned the house, something either hasn't worked or something's been happening. And I'm thinking in the, you know, in a kind of a tangential type of subject, water intrusion. You know, if a seller discloses on their real estate condition report there's no problems with water, yet the person who buys the house, you know, within 2 weeks of moving into the house has water coming in their basement with every other rain, that's pretty good evidence that the former owner of the house had a water problem and had to have known about it. So kind of similarly, if your daughter bought a house but the gas fireplace has only been turned on once and really hasn't worked, you might be able to explain the situation to the seller that they had to have known that there was an issue or a problem with that gas fireplace.
Yeah. So a letter to them to begin with would be the way to do it, as you're suggesting then.
Yeah, that's what I would recommend.
Yeah. There you go, Brock. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Kevin Trost, our guest today, attorney with the Axley Law Firm, as we talk about the legal side of housing sales, among other things here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at the legal side of housing sales today with our guest, Kevin Trost, attorney with the Axley Law Firm. Let's take another call. Todd in Tomahawk, it's your turn. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Larry. Hey, Kevin. My question is kind of a follow-up to the gentleman that called about using the road that they've maintained over the cemetery's property. I know that you referred to it as adverse possession, and I was wondering if you could give me a clarification on that, because we have a similar situation where we have what we believe is a prescriptive easement, or an easement by prescription, it might be referred to, on some family land that has run over some adjoining property for like 70 or 80 years. And my question more specifically would be, would we just simply be able to maintain that easement perpetually, or you referred to the adverse possession in the other gentleman's case. I mean, would you be able, you wouldn't take the land and be able to own it. I was just wondering if you could clarify that for me, please.
Sure. Yeah, not a problem. With adverse possession, you're dealing with a situation where it's somebody else's land. They haven't given you permission to use it, but you are using it, and you're using it in a way that if the owner of the land drives by or stops by, they can clearly see that somebody else is using their land without their permission. In contrast to that, you have an easement situation where you have the ability through permission to use the property. And it sounds like you're in a situation where you have an easement. In other words, at some point in time, somebody gave you permission to use the property. Either that, or it's a situation where you can have a landlocked parcel, and the only way that you can access the parcel is by going through somebody else's land, kind of an easement by necessity. In that situation, you're granted permission to use, you know, a reasonable portion of somebody else's land in order to access your parcel of land. Does that make sense?
It does, sir, but I should have perhaps been more clear. This, we do not have an actual easement. We've been running over that property for and maintaining it for in my family. I'm second generation or third generation, actually, where we've been going openly over that property and maintaining it. There never was an easement on it. I was, you know, told years back that it would be referred to as a prescriptive easement, you know, just kind of automatically becomes something that we would always be able to use perpetually as long as, you know, as long as we maintain the conditions that met that requirement. Would you be familiar with that?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that what you described is probably the case. And if somebody were to come along later and question it, you know, you could argue that you have a prescriptive easement, or if you've been really caring for the property and keeping up the road and whatnot, if somebody questions it in the future, you could also say, well, we've been doing this for multiple decades at this point in time. You know, if you really want to challenge it, we might just go to court and have it that part of the property declared to be ours now through adverse possession.
Okay. There you go, Todd. Thank you for calling. Dick in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Dick.
Hi. We purchased a house a couple months ago. We just moved in about 3 weeks ago and discovered that they had a cat. My wife said that she knew that they had a cat when we bought it, but it was never disclosed, you know, in the sale of stuff. And now we find out that we have to replace the carpet in the basement. We've shampooed, we've done all the stuff we can for it, but we can't get the smell out. So now we're putting in a $4,000 carpet. Do we have any recourse on that in terms of their sharing that there's cat pee in the basement?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, those situations do come up. Obviously, if you're going to ask the seller to pay for all or a portion of replacing the carpet, what you need to be able to show or convince, in this case, a small claims court commissioner, is that the sellers knew that there was a severe cat peeing problem that had affected the carpets in the basement or in some portion of the house. Do you think there is such evidence?
Well, we use a black light, and when you walk around with a black light, it shows all the different, I mean, it's really prevalent.
Okay.
I mean, it's everywhere in the basement.
Was there any, like, notorious smell or anything like that, too?
Well, according to my wife, there is. You know, I don't smell that well, but
sure.
You know, she says she can't stand it. So we've already ordered the carpet, and I thought, well, I'd just ask you if there's any kind of recourse. So it's probably small claims court. Is that it?
Yeah, it would be small claims court. In Wisconsin, anything under $10,000 is small claims, which is actually very, very citizen-friendly in that you can, there's a just a regular standard complaint form you can get off the internet, and the courts provide how-to instructions for what you have to do, you know, explaining your claim, and then how you serve it upon the other people. And they'll, when you file it with the court, they put the date and time right on there for when the person you're bringing the lawsuit against, the defendant, has to respond or appear in order to give a response to your complaint. And the court commissioner will take it from there. So it's really something that's very consumer and citizen friendly, in order to be able to pursue something yourself without having to involve an attorney.
All right. There you go, Dick. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Neil in Shattuck, your turn. Hi, Neil.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. One comment and one question. The insurance policies, I had an attorney tell me years ago to always look at the exclusions list on an insurance policy first to see what's excluded, so you don't have to necessarily read through the whole thing and try and decipher it. The best way is just to look at the exclusions list, which is usually at the end of the policy to understand what's not included in your insurance policies. So that's my first comment. I have a question. Interesting enough, you just talked about small claims. My daughter bought some land on an auction up here in Northwest Wisconsin at an auction company, well-known auction company up here. They actually own the land, so it wasn't auctioned off for somebody else. After she bought it and they were going to do the perk test, she paid cash for it. They were going to do a perk test and discovered that it's an old landfill. It was not disclosed on the deed, not anywhere on the deed, until you dig way back that the township did have it. They actually filed paperwork with the DNR that it was a landfill. It's above the amount for a small claims court. My question is, can a person do a partial small claims? I mean, at this point, we're kind of like, well, can we take a partial loss on this, cut our losses and run? Or, you know, is there any other action that can be taken? It seems like the attorneys don't really want to take such a small case. It's only a $15,000 piece of land. So, but
sure,
that's my question.
Yeah. And I've had that situation come up before. Even when it's closer to that $10,000 threshold for small claims versus circuit court. And if somebody's going into it knowing, you know, my claim's really worth more than $10,000, but I'm willing to cap out my potential recovery at $10,000, by all means, you can go through small claims court to handle it.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much, Neil, for calling. Appreciate it. A listener in Madison emailed to say their home inspector advises they not grant full right to cure, but the realty agent says that would create a problem. Are they able to request a say in what is repaired or replaced if something needs it? They haven't yet turned in the offer to and had the home inspection.
Well, that's kind of a curious situation because normally you're having the home inspection as one of your contingencies on your accepted offer to purchase. And with your offer to purchase, generally, when you fill that out before you submit it to the seller, there's a place in there where you'd have to designate whether the seller does or does not have the right to cure any defects that turn up with the home inspection. So if you're in a situation where the seller's allowed you to go through and do a home inspection first before you ever submitted an offer to purchase, then I think then you're not locked in. You have every opportunity to, you know, put whatever conditions you want on the offer that you would submit to the seller.
Yeah, that makes sense. Kevin Trost, our guest today, attorney with the Axley Law Firm, talking with him about the legal side of housing sales and some other matters as well that have come up. And I hope you'll join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. We'll take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Then we'll be back with Kevin Trost. He'll be with us right up till 12:30. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking about legal issues on the show today, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Kevin Trost, our guest, he is a partner in the Axley Law Firm, primarily deals with issues involving real estate, personal injury, and financial matters. And just a reminder, our talk today is intended as general information, and you shouldn't rely on it or construe it as being official legal advice. So, we have Russ in Stoughton, Wisconsin up next, Kevin. Let's go to Russ. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I had two comments. Number one, the gentleman that had the non-working fireplace, doesn't the real estate agent who represents the property have a legal responsibility to present it in all its glory or flaws and to a potential buyer? Because I know when we sold our last house, we had a gas log or a regular log fireplace. That's one of the first things she tried out. And the other thing is the gentleman with the road going through his property. Growing up in Illinois, if you put a fence 6 inches over your lot line and your neighbor's, if there was no confrontation about that for 7 years, an additional 6 or 10 inches or whatever you did became your property.
Hmm.
I'm wondering if that's true for Wisconsin or what.
Hmm. Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah, with regards to the realtor question or issue, that is a good thing to discuss because the realtors do have an obligation when you hire a realtor. Your realtor, when you're selling a house, has an obligation to do their own inspection of the property, you know, not to the full extent that you'd expect a home inspector to do it, but at least a cursory inspection of, you know, what they see when they're going through the house, and they might turn some things on to see if they work or not. Where it gets tricky in terms of a realtor's obligations and their legal duties is down the road. Because if somebody has a home inspection, that takes away or absolves the realtor's responsibility with regards to the inspection of the house. The realtors have a fairly good lobby in the state legislature. And so if somebody as a purchaser of a house has a home inspection, then the results of the home inspection trump, and the realtor's obligation of inspection kind of falls by the wayside. You know, kind of the instance where that might not be the case is if the realtor knows of something specifically wrong with the house and it doesn't get brought up during the home inspection, there's a question that or a potential issue that the realtor still has an affirmative obligation because they actually know of a problem that didn't come out during the home inspection.
Hmm. What about the 7-year law that Illinois may have on property?
Right. And it's, you know, it's fairly similar throughout the country. If you, you know, you own a piece of property, but somebody is, you know, violating your rights on that property by, in a very conspicuous way of doing something like putting a fence up on your property, or, you know, having a road run down the property and maintaining it, then as long as you're not, as a seller or the owner of the property, if you are not giving them permission to do that, then the people who are making that very obvious change to the property, to the character of your property, will have an opportunity or a legal opportunity down the road to come back and say that that property is either now ours or we have a, like, a prescriptive easement to continue doing that.
Hmm. Well, Stella in Sturgeon Bay has something that may relate well to that. Let's go there. Stella, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, it sounds like it does. we have a lot that we're preparing to sell, and it has a point, one point of, it's a triangular lot. One point of it is on the opposite side, crosses the road that that's a boundary on one side of the lot. And there's a neighbor's driveway that is adjacent to that point. And we don't know for sure, but it appears that the owner of the lot that has the driveway has done some permanent landscaping on our point. and I was wondering if we find when we get the corners marked, if we find that in fact they have done landscaping on our land, what can we do?
Well, if I were you, I would probably do exactly what I did with my first house, because when we bought a house in Middleton, which is right outside of Madison, there was a neighbor who had put up a fence, and it was slightly on our property. And so we went and we just gave them a letter saying, I see that you've done this, you know, either put flowers up on our property or put a fence up on our property. We want to recognize that you're doing that on our property, but we give you permission to do that. Because once you give them permission, that will really take away any claim for adverse possession that they could later come and try and claim that that property now is legally theirs.
Okay. What about the possibility of offering to sell them that portion?
Yeah, that's always an option as well. You can approach them and see if they want to buy that portion of the property.
Yeah, why not? That might be the best way to resolve the whole situation and avoid some other problems down the road with it, Stella. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Rhonda in Jackson, it's your turn. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi. We recently purchased a historic log farmhouse, and part of the value of it is the really mature trees and shrubs around it, and we love that part. But come to find out in talking to the new neighbors that the former owner knew that the road was going to be widened, and that all of those trees would be cut down and the road would come right up to the front porch, and that the owner had petitioned this and it still got passed anyway. But that was not shared with us, so we had no knowledge, and that really is going to cut the whole value of our property down. And I'm wondering if there's any recourse we have about that.
I think the short answer to that is yes. especially in a situation where it sounds like the sellers of the house were well aware of what was going to happen through the municipality and were trying to stop it, then that definitely shows their awareness of a problem affecting that property. And I think you would have legal recourse in that situation.
Yeah. Here you go, Rhonda.
Yeah. One thing that came to my mind, Larry, when she started to mention that it's a historic old house, just as a matter of interest, might be good to know whether or not somebody has to disclose when they're selling a house if they think their house is haunted.
Is that right?
And the answer to that varies depending upon where you are in the country. But here in Wisconsin, there's not an affirmative obligation on the part of a seller of a house to disclose that they think their house is haunted.
Oh, man. Rhonda, there you have it. Thank you very much. You got some potentially some recourse there. So you might want to look into that. Paul in Menasha, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. Thank you for
morning.
Taking my call.
Sure.
I have a parcel, a lot and a half, next to the property that my grandmother left me. And the parcel's in my mother's name. And I've been paying the taxes on this property since she's deceased, died like 10 years ago. And I was wondering about what I need to do to get this parcel in my name. I get the tax bill, and I had the county treasurer, put my name on the bill and send it to me. And I've been, like I say, paying these taxes for the last 10 years, and I was wondering what to do.
Okay.
Yeah, I think in that situation, you're probably good to try and go and get the parcel placed in your name. You should probably consult an attorney who's familiar with estate planning, trust and estates, that type of attorney, and they can go through the legal machinations, the legal steps that it takes in order to get that parcel placed in your name. And I'm assuming that if you have any siblings or anybody else who, would have inherited following your mother's death, that they wouldn't have any issue or problem with it.
There you go, Paul.
Pretty complicated. Thank you. I will contact an attorney.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to Kevin in Eagle River next. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Hey, appreciate your call.
Glad you're here. We bought a house 2 years ago. It's a 1938 log home, beautiful condition relative to its age. We had an inspector come in. He had the option of going green, yellow, or red, and the option of, get someone to look at these things. In each of these cases, they were marked green, go, everything's perfect. The furnace, cracked furnace box, the exhaust was completely corroded out and was putting carbon monoxide into the house. We discovered that when we had friends come over and they were getting sick. We had this all photographed when the furnace was replaced. There were stains all over the house indicating the carbon was coming into the house as well. The stairs, he gave that a green, and the treads differ by height and, depth, up to 3 inches, 4 inches. And we learned later that the guy who bought the house before fell down and did serious injury on those stairs. The fireplace was pouring water into the house. He mentioned that tuck pointing would be needed, but that wasn't the problem. I poured a new cap on the chimney. And the roof flashing had holes in it. The electrical, there were taped together things that he completely missed, and he gave it a green approval. I'm worried now, 2 years in, after we've discovered all, we replaced all the electrical, we replaced the furnace. I've rebuilt the chimney in its entirety. Do we have a recourse here?
I think you do. Because it sounds like from what you're describing, and I'm sorry you had to go through this whole ordeal and find all kinds of hidden defects and problems that you weren't expecting. But it looks like, from what you're saying, that there were a number of signs that this home inspector should have picked up on in order to determine whether or not there were problems and identify problems with the house. For example, the electrical, if stuff was just taped together and if that was readily visible to the inspector, that's something the inspector should have pointed out. Similarly with the carbon monoxide, if he said there were signs from, like carbon monoxide, changes in the coloring in various areas as a result of soot going through the house. That's something the home inspector should likely have picked up on. Now, there's a lot of good home inspectors out there, and, you know, and some of them, even if they are good, they can, you know, just have a bad day and not catch stuff. But nevertheless, that's their professional duty. If there's something that's readily visible to be seen that would constitute a defect or a problem with the property, that's what you hire them to do, to try and figure it out.
Yeah. All right. There you go, Kevin. Thank you very much for calling. John in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hey, Larry. Right to it. I'm actually a renter. I'm about to move out. I gave my landlord, I've been there about 7 years. They're good people, but I gave them the notice like a week ago. And in my monthly agreement, I guess we have a monthly agreement, and it says you got to let them know 30 days ahead of time or whatever if you're moving. So because of that, she's saying I can't get my security deposit back. Is that true? Or, and what constitutes is wear and tear, because there's like a hole in the wall, and that's all. But we've been there 7 years. They don't really do anything to fix the place. It's a dump. So I'm just wondering what's like my recourse. Shouldn't I still be entitled to my security deposit or no?
Well, I think it sounds like if you're on a month-to-month and you're supposed to give them 30 days notice, if you gave them 30 days notice, then you should absolutely be entitled to security deposit, you know, subject to any offsets for things that go beyond wear and tear. If, you know, if you're giving them less than 30 days notice, then what they would have a right to do is charge you for that next month's rent.
Okay.
If you're giving them, obviously, if you're giving them notice in a shorter period of time than when you were supposed to.
All right. But that's different from the security deposit, right?
Yeah, that's different from the security deposit. Now, I mean, the landlord might be saying, you know, if your security deposit was 1 month's rent, then we're going to take your security deposit as next month's rent, which you'd be obligated to pay because you didn't give us the full 30 days notice.
Gotcha. So there you go, John. It sounds like there's a problem there in terms of getting your money back, although you might want to do the math on it and kind of figure out, is the security deposit, is that going to cost me less than if I had to pay for another month's rent? It's something to think about for sure. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. A listener emailed to ask if there's any legal recourse for a property owner who lives adjacent to a dilapidated property that negatively affects the value of their property.
Potentially. Yeah, I mean, I think the first place I would go with that type of issue is I'd go to my municipality and see if the municipality has taken any steps to, declare the neighboring property to be a nuisance or an eyesore or something of that nature. Because it might be that your municipality is trying to affirmatively deal with this issue that your neighbor has. And if not, maybe you going to the municipality will set things in motion.
Hmm. Deb in Plymouth emailed that her son won a small claims case against a landlord who had many apartments in Sheboygan. He hasn't been able to collect the money. Apparently, she keeps her bank account under an amount that no claims can ever be collected. The landlord owes him $950, and she keeps around $3,000 in her account. Does he have any recourse?
Well, I mean, obviously, the one thing that they've been trying to do to get the money is looking at bank garnishment, going after the landlord's accounts. You can also have the judgment that you have against the landlord recorded in the county where the landlord has property. And so if there's property in the landlord's name in that county, the judgment will serve as a lien against that property. So if the landlord ever were to try and go sell the property in the future, you know, it would, that judgment would come up on a title report, and it would be something that would need to get dealt with prior to the property being sold.
So there's some recourse, although if she doesn't sell, you're kind of, you may be out then?
Well, I wouldn't say you're out. She'll have a continue to have a judgment for a period of time, at least for 10 years, and you can try at various points in time to collect on that. You can also ask the, well, demand that the landlord come in for what's called a creditor's exam, where they have to show up and provide all the documentary information with regards to their finances, bank accounts, and whatnot. And a lot of times people will rather try and make a deal and get rid of the judgment rather than go through the rigmarole of having to do that.
Hmm. Sue in Green Bay emailed, they signed a contract for the building of a new house nearly a year ago. Recently, they noticed that the builder's profit is listed as two different percentages in different places on the contract, 8% and 9%. When she called the builder, he said that someone had forgotten to change the figure to the higher amount. Any ideas if you can settle this? The contract was signed by both parties with the error.
Well, I mean, you can go back to the builder and say, hey, you know, we signed this contract and we saw the 8% amount, and that's what we were relying on when we were signing the contract. And so therefore demand that the builder honor the 8% profit amount.
Yeah, and if the builder doesn't, then it has to go to court, I assume.
Well, go to court, or you can, you know, you can always simply say, hey, it sounds like we never reached a full meeting of the minds with regards to this build, and therefore I think we can walk away from this contract.
Oh, yeah, that's the other approach. Well, especially
if the builder hasn't started work yet.
On that happy note, Kevin, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us. I hope you'll come back and do this again. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'd love to, Larry. It's nice talking with you.
Yeah, nice talking with you. Kevin Trost, attorney who specializes in lots of things relating to homes and home sales and commercial litigation, partner in the Axley Law Firm. Great to have him with us. Tomorrow, my goodness, it's Friday, Garden Talk time. So I hope you'll join us for those gardening questions. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store. I'm Larry Mehler.